Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the showdown in the House of Representatives, with one day left before the government runs out of money after the Senate has passed a clean funding bill without the provision to defund Planned Parenthood, Obamacare, and the implementation of the Iran deal. John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California's Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff, joins us to discuss his recent article at the New York Times, John Boehner Fades Away. And, assuming we avoid a government shutdown tomorrow, what will happen on December the 11th when the government runs out of money again? Then we'll assess Russian President Putin's recent interview with Charlie Rose on 60 Minutes and his speech before the UN with one of Putin's bravest critics, Masha Gessen, the author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. We will discuss how the wily Russian leader easily parried Charlie Rose's softball questions and whether Putin will be able to organize a coalition of anti-American countries to resist what he perceives as U.S. domination, challenging the UN with the charge that, quoting, after the end of the Cold War, the single center of domination has emerged in the world. Those who have found themselves on top of the pyramid were tempted to think that since they are so strong and singular, they know what to do better than others, and it's unnecessary to pay attention to the UN. Then finally, we will speak with Ian Ayers, a professor at Yale Law School and the Yale School of Management, about his article at the Los Angeles Times, Fix VW's Polluting Diesels and Fix the Recall System Too. We'll discuss how most states do not have compulsory smog checks and that voluntary recalls often result in 70% of owners not bothering to get their cars fixed. So given that recalling the rigged VW diesel cars would mean that the fix will result in a penalty of performance and mileage, how likely is it that owners of polluting VW diesels will answer the recall? And joining us now is John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. He has an article at the New York Times, John Boehner Fades Away. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Lawrence.
Thank you very much.
And even though John Boehner is fading away, it does feel as though he has fallen on his sword and given the nihilists, if you want to call the Freedom Caucus or the Tea Party, that the extent to which at this point we've got a day left before the government runs out of money, the Senate has passed a clean funding bill without the provisions to defund Planned Parenthood, Obamacare, and the implementation of the Iran deal. Do you think that Boehner's exit is sufficient? They've got his scalp. Do they want to shut down the government now?
Well, I think that there are many people within the Republican caucus who would be perfectly happy to shut down the government with or without the Planned Parenthood money, because I don't think that they view government in a manner that they believe it's necessary to enhance its standing or its reputation. I think that Mr. Boehner, that his plans, both before and after his announcement of his resignation, were to rely on Democratic votes to pass the continuing resolution without the Planned Parenthood money in it. I don't think he had to resign to do that. He would have made a deal, just as he's made a deal on a regular basis on continuing resolutions, on debt ceilings, on other must-pass legislation, to keep the government open and operating since 2011. He resigned because he knew that by doing that, he would enrage that group of his caucus again. But he didn't have to resign in order to get that resolution passed.
Well, he's nevertheless, obviously, he was quite emotional the day that he hosted the Pope and the day after. I mean, is it battle fatigue? And what's your explanation then if he's not falling on his sword for that particular reason?
I think he's tired of having a weary fight with people within his own caucus who simply cannot be satisfied. And I think that he knew that if he was able successfully to persuade Democrats to support a clean continuing resolution, which he certainly would have been successful, that would have provoked a whole new round of opposition to him. And I think that in the end, he was delaying the inevitable. He was not going to be able to persuade that element in his caucus to behave responsibly, and I think he just lost his appetite for continually having to do that.
So assuming we avoid a government shutdown tomorrow, what will happen on December the 11th when the government runs out of money? By then, will we have either his Kevin McCarthy, the most likely successor, or Trey Gowdy is now making a run for the speakership as well?
Well, I think that very little is likely to change between now and December the 11th. When December the 11th comes around, or for that matter, when the debt ceiling vote happens, that may be before Mr. Boehner leaves, it may be after he leaves, the circumstances are going to be pretty much the same. That is, there's going to be a faction within the Republican caucus in the House which is going to demand that those must-pass bills include provisions that cannot pass the Senate, will not be signed by the president, cannot become law by overriding the president's veto, and will not be able to attract Democratic votes, and therefore they will not be included. And that's going to be the case whether Mr. McCarthy is the speaker, or Mr. Gowdy is the speaker, or anyone else is going to be the speaker. So when you rise to the level of the speakership, you have responsibilities to make the government function. There's a time and a place for fights over specific policies, whether it's the Affordable Care Act or it's funding of Planned Parenthood, or for that matter, whether it's funding over continuing the funding for the war in Iraq, which is what Speaker Pelosi had to persuade her caucus to do. She didn't agree with that policy, but she understood that you don't shut down the government. Those circumstances are not going to change. The only thing that will change, I think, is that you will have, regardless of which of these men becomes the next speaker, a far less skilled, far less experienced person in that job, having to achieve these same results, and they will have to send the message to the Tea Party caucus exactly like Mr. Boehner did, and that is, we have to pass a clean bill or we face a government shutdown. When you look at what happened to the Republican Party, the Republican brand, when you look at the $25 billion that was lost in the last government shutdown, I don't think that's something that Speaker McCarthy or a Speaker Gowdy or any other speaker is going to want to do as we move into the election season.
And again, I'm speaking with John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff. He has an article at the New York Times, John Boehner Fades Away. So how much is this, though, a structural problem that's come from the gerrymandering, the successful gerrymandering by the Republicans, led in part by Karl Rove? And in many ways, there was a research done by political scientist Tom Ferguson on the funding for the Tea Party insurgency. And a lot of it came from Wall Street and other wealthy interests like the Koch brothers, etc. So there are two questions here. One is, is there buyer's remorse on the part of those who put these people in? And I'm not sure why they did. And two, given that the gerrymandering is such that none of these Republican office holders feel threatened by the Democrats. There's no Democrats going to run against them. The only person who's going to run against them is somebody from their right. And is that the engine that's driving Republican politics further and further to the right?
On the gerrymandering question, gerrymandering is certainly a significant piece of what happened following the census in 2010. Republicans were very successful in winning state legislatures and governorships, and they used those victories to design districts which are under attack by the courts in Florida and North Carolina, Virginia, and other places, Texas, because they serve to disenfranchise large numbers of citizens, in many cases minorities, and creating safe seats for a large number of these Republicans. Now, as to the question of money, obviously money is a very pernicious influence in politics in general. I think what's an interesting conflict that's emerging here is between this independent money, the Koch brothers and some of the other major sources of independent expenditures, and some of the traditional Republican money, which has come from the business community and people, groups like the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable, their interests are not synonymous. Those latter group, the sort of the older Republican money interests, are certainly very engaged in politics, and they've become a little bit more engaged as they've seen the growth of the Tea Party begin to eat into the influence that they've had in the party. They're very concerned about issues like government shutdown, about the debt ceiling, about the Export-Import Bank, about the Highway Trust Fund, about the fact that we can't get long-term funding through the normal appropriations process, because the business community dislikes any kind of catastrophic economic news, and they depend upon some sort of a certainty, whether it's in tax policy or spending policy, trade policy. And that's very different from the Koch brothers and many of the independent expenditures who are coming in now with vast amounts of money, have more of a libertarian perspective, who are not interested in necessarily policies which the traditional business community has supported. So that creates a huge crisis within the Republican Party that can be seen on this ongoing basis when you look at some of these key pieces of legislation that are necessary to provide the business community with the stability that they need. And that, of course, puts the economy at risk, as well as the stability of the government, and certainly the stability of the Republican Party.
But surely the traditional levers and means of control in terms of party discipline have gone away, in as much as you can't necessarily cajole or bribe this insurgent group, Freedom Caucus, with committee assignments or money for campaigns if they're, one, independently financed, and two, then all they care about is who's going to be running to their right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's true. I mean, you did see Speaker Boehner try to punish some of these critics when they voted against him for Speaker, and he removed them from their committees. But ultimately, that only served to pour gasoline on the fire by further establishing that he was not a member in good standing of that Tea Party far-right caucus. They do have independent sources of money. There are actions that you can take. I think that Speaker Boehner could have done to really challenge them. But I think for a lot of the members of this caucus, you're correct. The last thing they want to do is to provoke a further challenge to them on the right. The nature of American politics is that a very small percentage of the registered voters in most districts decides who gets nominations, and that's really where the Tea Party's been very successful. If you only have 5 or 10% of the voters in your primary coming out to vote, and they are the most passionate, they end up being very influential with respect to who wins nominations, and we've seen that over and over again in these Republican districts that more extreme candidates are able to secure nominations. That's precisely why people who may not share many of the positions and predilections of the Tea Party nevertheless are not going to vote against them if they can avoid it, because they really do not want to invite that kind of a challenge. So even though the Tea Party may be 40 or 50 people within the Republican caucus, they have an inhibitory effect on a much larger number. What Speaker Boehner really needed to do, it seems to me, and I think that my advice to Mr. McCarthy or to whoever ends up being Speaker, is you're going to have to stand up to these people. You're going to have to say, I have to make decisions here, and I have to run the government, and you're going to have to move forward. Now, that's what Mr. Boehner did on spending bills. As I say, if you look back at the passage of continuing resolutions or debt ceilings, omnibus spending bills, tax expiration bills, going back to the very beginning of his speakership, almost all of those bills were passed with Democratic votes. I make that point in that New York Times op-ed, because he always had a faction of Republicans who would not support him, and he had no choice. When you do that, ironically, that empowers the Democrats, because if they wanted to pass legislation only with Republican votes, they could craft a very different kind of a bill than if you had to go to Nancy Pelosi and say, I need 30 or 40 of your votes. Nancy Pelosi, of course, is going to say, well, if you put any riders on that, or if your funding levels are too low in programs I care about, I can't get you those votes. And so they inadvertently play directly into the hands of the Democrats and give the Democrats more power than the minority might otherwise have. They're going to have to make that decision. Are they going to be able to pass legislation on their own by keeping some of these very controversial, very divisive, and non-enactable provisions off their bills, or are they going to continue to rely on the Democratic caucus to provide the votes they need to pass these bills? And in doing so, they're going to keep those bills much more to the Democrats' liking than would otherwise be the case.
Well, just in closing, John Lawrence, when you mentioned the tyranny of the minority, if you will, or, you know, the squeaky wheel getting the grease, if indeed the Tea Party or the Freedom Caucus is a small minority and that they do dominate the primary process, and I think that certainly can apply to what we're seeing with the Republican presidential race, does that in any way give the Democrats a free pass? Because, you know, it would seem to me that you should win elections based upon having better ideas than having the other side self-destruct.
Well, you know, you can't run. There's an axiom of politics that you can't run your opponent's campaign for them. So, you know, I don't think there's any shortage of Democratic proposals out there on a whole range of issues. I don't think that the Democrats are not putting alternative legislative proposals out. Mrs. Pelosi and the Democrats put ideas out every day on higher education or on clean air or on climate change or on tax policy. Those options are out there. It's really, and certainly in the case of the presidential campaign, there will be many, many policy alternatives that are floated by Democrats both at the presidential and the congressional level. But at the moment, the Republicans are in the majority in the House and the Senate, and the public is going to be called upon to make a judgment in November of 2016 as to whether or not they have demonstrated the leadership skills that the public supports to continue to place the responsibility of being the majority with that party. Now, that's not done on a national level. It's done on a district-by-district level. And there's a reason why the public has 15% support for the Congress right now. They don't see a Congress that is able to address issues that are not only Democratic or Republican priorities, but priorities for both parties. And immigration reform is a perfect example. Over 70% of the American people support, over 70% of Republicans support, and they can't even get to bring that legislation to the House floor. So there's going to be a judgment, I think, that goes beyond the question of specific policies for and against, and is going to go to the question that you raise, Ian. It's going to go to the question of, is this the group of people I can entrust with the responsibilities of running the legislative branch of government? And if the answer to that is no, then I think Republicans are going to pay a consequence, and they need to be very, very conscious of that as they move into this next phase of selecting their leadership and determining how they're going to respond in December to the next fiscal cliff to which they are steering the car. That's inevitable.
Well, John Lawrence, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who has worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff. He has an article at the New York Times, John Boehner Fades Away. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing Russian President Putin's recent interview on 60 Minutes and his speech before the UN.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual flair. Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Masha Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist who has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate, among other publications. Masha has served as editor of the Russian-language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and her latest book about the Sinara brothers is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Masha Gessen.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
And before speaking at the UN, President Putin of Russia had a 60 Minutes interview with Charlie Rose, and I take it it got pretty high ratings, which is pretty common for 60 Minutes. But it seemed to me that the wily Russian president just absolutely ran rings around Charlie Rose, who was asking pretty much a series of softball questions. How did it strike you?
I'd say I'd agree with your assessment. And I don't know that it's possible to do a good interview with Putin. It's impossible to do a good interview with somebody whose way of being involves constantly claiming the right to say whatever the hell he pleases, right, with no relationship to reality. So unless you're going to fact-check him on the fly, you are not going to be able to get a good interview out of him. I think it was a valuable thing in the sense that it made it very clear, in some ways more clear than the speech at the UN, what Putin came to the U.S. for. And what he came for was to lay out his view of the world. It was a somewhat different Putin than we're used to seeing. You know, he wasn't the sort of the swaggering, saber-rattling Putin. It was the statesman Putin, you know, whom I haven't observed in more than a decade. And I think he's really trying to claim a place as a world leader. But I think that that he's actually counting on the merits of his worldview to do that.
But in terms of when you say it's pretty difficult to interview Putin because he has his own version of reality and he's not necessarily talking about the truth, but he's talking about his version of the truth. And you had a face-to-face meeting with him in the Kremlin. Was that your personal experience?
Well, that meeting was a somewhat different genre. That was just the totally bizarre and surreal realm of communication, but it was similar in the sense that he was there to say what he wanted to say. Mm-hmm. It was really bizarre. It was very interesting to learn how he saw what he was describing. Mm-hmm. But you know, there was no chance of calling him to task.
No, you weren't interviewing. He was calling you in to sort of offer you a kind of bribe.
Actually, I think he sincerely wanted me to go back to work after I'd been fired. He felt, you know, Putin has this thing when he likes something, he thinks that he owns it. And he really sincerely liked the magazine that I edited, so he wanted to put it back the way it was. He felt that the publisher had overreacted by firing me. And, of course, the publisher was trying to do Putin's bidding because he fired me for refusing to cover Putin's hang gliding adventure. So he wanted to put it back together. He was convinced that he was making me the offer that I wanted. Just to give you an idea of how sort of closed he is in his view of reality, I never accepted the offer. But when his press secretary commented on my accounting of the meeting, he said, yes, that's all accurate, except she accepted the job.
So, do you know anything about how this interview was arranged? Obviously, it was done in Moscow. Would it be a situation where any journalist, I don't think Charlie Rose is, he has a good reputation, but I've never found him particularly incisive. But nevertheless, that's just a personal opinion. Would it be possible to, for example, interview Putin and say, you know, my understanding is that, you know, you basically run a gangster state and you're the capo de capo, the mafia boss, and you're bleeding the country blind and beguiling everybody with a kind of bread and circuses nationalism, and you're taking the country to hell. I mean, I don't know.
Oh, Ian, you should ask for an interview with Putin.
Well, let's tone it down a bit. Is there any way that you think he could be confronted in a way that could break his cleverness? Because, for example, when Charlie Rose did say, you know, he attributed it to Senator Marco Rubio, who said, you know, that you're a gangster, and then Putin immediately shot back and saying, gangster? I mean, that's ridiculous. I was a KGB man. That's incompatible. It doesn't make any sense. Of course, that's a totally fraudulent answer, because the KGB were the ones that regulated crime in the Soviet Union and were the first to form alliances with criminals in post-Soviet Russia.
So to answer your first question, do I know anything about the interview? I know that it was a couple of years in the making. I know that Charlie Rose worked very, very hard to get it. It's highly unusual for Putin to sit down for an interview like that. You know, his contact with the press is generally limited to one annual pre-scripted press conference that goes on for hours and involves pre-cleared questions. And a tiny dwindling pool that has very, very limited access. So propaganda films. So in the last year, he's probably had more one-on-one interviews than he ever had before, but most of them have been with Russian journalists for the purposes of making these epic, heroic films for Russian television. This is highly unusual. I can see why it was as constricted as it was. But even, I don't think that Charlie Rose asked great questions, but I'm afraid that even if he'd asked better questions, the kind of questions that you were just giving as examples, which are definitely better, the result would have been much the same. He is impenetrable. He's not a good communicator. He's not a brilliant man, but he is pretty well trained in that kind of sort of one-sided communication. And he has a deep understanding of the fact that, again, you know, claiming the right to say whatever the hell he pleases, like there are no Russian troops in Ukraine, actually gives him the upper hand in any conversation. And that's the basic model, and you can break through that.
And again, I'm speaking with Masha Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist who has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate, among other publications. Masha has served as editor of the Russian-language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and her latest book about the Sinara brothers is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. So, you know, the one thing that gangsters crave, particularly, you know, the old Godfather, is they want respect. And my sense is that was perhaps Putin's Achilles heel, that if you didn't give him the respect and called it like it is and called his regime like it is, that might be better than the kind of denial which is very common in the State Department. We often like to think about countries the way that we'd like to see them rather than the way they are. To the extent to which we're told that Obama sees Putin as a thug and Putin sees Obama as a weakling, has Obama's ostracizing him and perhaps treating him disrespectfully, has it worked?
I think it's worked. I think but it also made him resort to blackmail. I mean, he has built up Russia's presence in Syria in advance of the General Assembly in order to get a meeting with Obama. And basically the Kremlin's message to the White House was, you can't ignore us, you can't make us into a pariah, because otherwise we're going to keep creating trouble for you in Syria. The thing is, they're going to keep creating trouble all over the world no matter what. I mean, the White House, Obama's caving in and taking a meeting with Putin in the end was a total victory for Putin and led to no progress in Syria, which was a completely predictable outcome. And I think the basic fallacy that leads to these repeated failures is this idea that that sanctions or ostracism can somehow influence Putin's behavior. That is not the case. I mean, he's not going to change who he is and what he does in the world because of the way the West acts. So sanctions and ostracism need to be, I think they're the right thing to do, they're just being done for the wrong reasons. They need to be based not on this idea that somehow they will influence Putin. They need to be based on the very clear idea of morals. It is immoral to sit down at the table with a dictator who is raping a neighboring country, killing his own people, throwing them in jail. It is immoral to sit down with him to decide the fate of another country. And that's, you know, that should be the U.S. position.
Well, but to some extent, though, the U.S. doesn't have totally clean hands. I mean, as much as Putin is supporting a disgusting regime in Syria, we support disgusting regimes like the Saudi Arabians, who's one of the richest countries in the world, that's now bombing one of the poorest countries in the world, Yemen, and blocking any attempt on the part of the U.N. to investigate the human rights disasters and the humanitarian catastrophe that is ensuing in Yemen.
Oh, I completely agree. But, you know, having a politics based on morals actually might do some good in that department as well.
I see. So it just has to be a universally accepted position. I guess we have to go back to Jimmy Carter for that. But what about Putin's real concerns, or Russia's security concerns? Whether, I don't know exactly how much Putin is using it, or how much he's doing about the genuine threat that the Islamic State poses to Russia, because two of the top commanders in the Islamic State are Chechens. They're brothers, as a matter of fact. One is the Islamic State's treasurer, and the other one commands the northern front along the Syrian-Turkish border. And there's about 2,000 to 5,000 Russians in the Islamic State, and nobody quite knows how many's returned. And about 80% of the jihadis inside of Russia have dedicated their allegiance to the Islamic State. The other 20% are still allied with al-Qaeda. So on the surface, it would seem, given Russia's, what, about 11 million Muslims in its population, that it has more of a serious problem in terms of potential blowback from the Islamic State than the U.S. has, where the U.S. apparently has about 250 Americans in the Islamic State.
Well, one short-term, I mean, this is, I should preface this by saying that information about this is extremely difficult to get and corroborate, right? So even the numbers that you've just used, you know, I think we have to take all of that with a grain of salt, because none of that is really possible to corroborate. But one thing I understand that Russia has done is decided not to let people who've gone to Syria to fight, Russian citizens, not to let them return to Russia. And in the short term, and this is very typical sort of Russian thinking, Putin-era thinking, because it's always short-term thinking. In the short term, they've decided that it's actually better to let people out to go fight in Syria and then not let them come back in. But that will keep Russia safe, because it will sort of have a steam valve for the potential jihadis inside Russia. I don't think there's any serious conversation about the long-term threat of the Islamic State to Russia, because, again, Putin is not capable of long-term thinking, and his perception of security is also rather warped. He completely identifies his own personal ability to stay in power with Russia's security, because he thinks he is the Russian state. So when he's protecting, when he talks about protecting Russia, he's really talking about protecting his own regime.
And in fact, your point's well taken about so little is known about the Islamic State. And just to correct something, Muslims make up about 11% of Russia's 143 million people. Military intelligence analysts here in the United States are having an internal bureaucratic battle with their top brass, who they accuse of sanitizing some of the information. So, and of course, it's no small irony that today at the United Nations, President Obama is convening a joint session on how to collectively combat terrorism and the Islamic State. But Putin is not playing a role in it. But tomorrow at the United Nations, where Russia is now the president, Russia is convening another meeting. So even on the issue of the Islamic State, you have competing meetings, if you will.
Right. I think that actually underscores the impossibility, I think, of cooperation. It also underscores the true nature of Putin's agenda. I mean, he was he came here to primarily to demonstrate to the people back home that he is once again a major player, that they don't have a choice but to sit down at the table with him. It was clear, actually, it was interesting to watch the speech because he was very nervous, very concentrated, very earnest. And when he sat down after he'd given his speech, he was biting his lip, he was fidgeting with his watch. He held his knees sort of close together, very uncharacteristic of him. He was not feeling confident. He was doing something that felt risky and very, very important to him. But what he was proposing in terms of the anti-terrorist coalition, and he did mention an anti-terrorist coalition, an international anti-terrorist coalition in his speech, he likened it to the anti-Hitler coalition formed during World War II, which is very telling because he does, that would be sort of the perfect scenario for him. As we recall, when Russia when the Soviet Union joined the anti-Hitler coalition, the sins of its recent past were swiftly forgotten. In the 2 years leading up to that moment, the Soviet Union had annexed part of Finland, half of Poland, and all of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. So this looks like a great opportunity, and Putin is not a deep but a methodical student of history. This seems looks to him like a great opportunity to sort of play this the same gambit and have the United States lay off its criticism of his behavior in Ukraine, let him have Crimea, let him have eastern Ukraine, perhaps let him have all of Eurasia as his dominion in exchange for joining this imaginary anti-terrorist coalition.
Well, what he seemed to be, though, concentrating on in his speech at the UN, Vladimir Putin, was this sort of grudge that he has against the U.S., where he called upon, I don't know the extent to which he's trying to organize an anti-American coalition, but he called upon countries to resist what he perceives as U.S. domination, and he challenged the UN with the charge that, quoting, after the end of the Cold War, the single center of domination has emerged in the world. Those who have found themselves on top of the pyramid were tempted to think that since they are so strong and singular, they know what to do better than others, and it's unnecessary to pay attention to the UN. Is he driven by that kind of chip on his shoulder?
Absolutely. That was the point of the speech. The point of the speech was that the big enemy, the threat to world order, the threat to the UN in particular, is the United States. And so sinister is this enemy that in the 23 minutes that Putin was speaking, he never actually said the United States. He never mentioned the country that he was talking about by name.
So is there, I mean, I understand that resonates with the Russian people to the extent that, and by the way, this came up in the interview with Charlie Rose tangentially when he talked about, in answer to, do you believe that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the world's greatest tragedy? And he went on to say, well, it was a tragedy for all those Russian people who found themselves in foreign countries as second-class citizens. But my understanding is that there is, you know, collective sense of humiliation of one day being a superpower and the next day being a beggar state. And is Putin exploiting that, if I'm correct in suggesting that that's very much a strain in Russian culture?
It is very much a strain in Russian culture, but it's a real sort of chicken and egg problem. In the 1990s, Russia played with the possibility of having a sort of post-imperial, post-superpower identity and didn't go through with this process. And then Putin came in, and you know, he's been in power since 1999. He's been in power for 16 years. And he came in and really began to build a politics based on this nostalgia for the superpower status, for the glory that came to Russia after World War II. And it's no accident that in his speech, again, he began with World War II and ended with World War II. He began by claiming erroneously that the United Nations was formed at the Yalta Conference and ended by referring to the anti-Hitler coalition. That's what he wants Russia to be. He wants it to be the post-World War II Soviet Union and a world power that used its victory in World War II to become a superpower.
Good luck with that, I say. I mean, how do you do it? I guess you do it in any way you can.
You add exports of neighboring countries. You blackmail other countries. You interfere all over the world just to cause trouble by sponsoring radical opposition movements, as Russia does all over Europe, by aiding both far right nationalist movements and secessionist movements all over Europe. You do it by forming opportunistic coalitions within international organizations like the United Nations, where Russia has formed the Traditional Values Coalition, and has had a fruitful relationship with a number of Muslim countries and other powers ranging from Ecuador to China.
Right, but back home, at the heart of the empire, and of course this was always the paradox in the Soviet days, that the standard of living in Prague, Czechoslovakia, was higher than it was in Moscow. It was an unusual empire where the periphery had a higher standard of living than the home. But in this case, having shed most of the empire back at home, Putin is hollowing out the state. The intelligentsia are leaving, the talent are leaving, the entrepreneurs are leaving. Who wants to invent something or start a company in a country where the mafia basically takes over?
Oh, but he's not building a modern state. He's building a revisionist retro state. So the fact the intelligentsia is leaving and the fact that the entrepreneurs are leaving doesn't bother him very much. It bothers him that capital is fleeing, but capital flight seems to be lessening because what could flee has already fled. And he compensates for the trouble in the economy by mobilizing the population more and more. And in a sense, he is of the Russian people in the way that that they're comfortable with the sort of with combining economic hardship and a state of constant mobilization.
Back to the future. Well, I thank you, Marcia Gessen. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's great to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Marcia Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate, among other publications, and has served as editor of the Russian-language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and her latest book about the Sonara brothers is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how it's not just necessary to fix VW's polluting cars, it's also necessary to fix the recall system too.
I can hold my head still with my hands at my knees. His eyes are the eyes of the old, shivering and bold. I will try not to breathe. This decision is mine. I have lived a full life. These are the eyes that I.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ian Ayres, who's a professor at Yale Law School and the Yale School of Management and editor of the Journal of Law, Economics, and Organization. He has been a columnist for Forbes magazine, a commentator on public radio's Marketplace, and a contributor to the New York Times Freakonomics blog. His books include the New York Times bestseller Super Crunches and, most recently, Carrots and Sticks, Unlock the Power of Incentive to Get Things Done. He also has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Fix VW's Polluting Diesels and Fix the Recall System Too. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Ayres.
Thanks.
And what do you think is the overall damage, not just to the United States, but to Europe in terms of the cheating or the fraud that Volkswagen has played upon the public? It was the assumption has been that the Europeans moved to clean diesel because of the better mileage and lower CO2 emissions, and that the NOx was being taken care of. And it's clear that in retrospect, they have been fooled in a huge way. And also, to some extent, the American people, to a lesser extent, I guess, have also been fooled, along with the American taxpayer, who paid out green subsidies for people here in the United States who bought VW clean diesels.
So true. There's the important environmental damage that has occurred, will continue to occur for some period into the future. And there's the, in some ways, scarier issue of this lack of confidence that the public, that regulators have, not just in VWs, but in car manufacturers more generally.
So does this mean then that the EPA mandates are not worth the paper they're written on unless there's an enforcement mechanism? Does the EPA have to now get proactive?
I think yes, more proactive. I would not go as far to say that they're not worth the paper they're written on, but as with the Tour de France, you'd be a rube if you thought everybody was clean after you have evidence of such a large-scale fraud.
So is there then, we know, for example, and as you've written about in your article in the Los Angeles Times, Ian Ayers, that the fact that California mandates a lot of pollution controls and even going back to airbags, et cetera, and they've got the clout as a state because of the enormous sales of autos in this state, and they have been leading the way. But you're saying that, in fact, the rest of the country needs to follow California's path. So in terms of, for example, smog controls, what other states have them, in the sense that if the solution to this problem with VW, which may not be a solution, but at least it will bring about some, I guess, honesty, is to have these diesels recalled?
Yeah, it's a great question. There, I believe there are six other states, but in fact, I can't name them for you at the moment. But the key factor that these states have in common is that they are going to block owners of these cars from staying on the road. The cars won't pass their annual emissions checks if they have not been repaired. And what's remarkable is that the large majority of states, though, at the current time, do not require owners to actually get their cars repaired when there is an emissions recall or a safety recall.
So the recalls that we keep hearing about, and they happen quite frequently with most car manufacturers at one point or another, that's entirely voluntary. I mean, it's
with regard to the owners. That's right. And 70% of owners take advantage of the recalls, but 30% do not. And in this case, I think there's a likelihood that half the owners will overlook the recall notice, because it's not just a hassle to take your car in, but you're going to be taking it in, and the present at the end of it is that your car will get fewer miles per gallon, and that extra economic cost is sadly, I think, going to lead many owners, hundreds of thousands of cars in states outside, not like California, to keep these dirty, spewing machines on the road.
So just moving on to then the idea of fixing the recall system, given that it's both voluntary and doesn't result in everybody taking advantage of it, whether it's for a safety issue, which I assume when you have a safety issue involved, more people would take advantage of it and take their cars in. But in this case, as you pointed out, you're taking your car in to essentially get penalized.
That's right. But even with safety issues, there's a problem, and I'm part of the problem. As I wrote in this op-ed, I own a Prius that had a sudden acceleration recall on it, and I was part of the 30% that did not exercise the option to have this repaired. Other things came up, or I forgot about it, and when I failed to respond to the recall, I didn't just put myself at risk. I put my fellow citizens at risk. This isn't This isn't a choice that merely burdens me, but it was when citizens respond to safety recalls that make other people less safe. That's another place where, with technology, we should just make it hard for you to keep driving the car for more than a year, let's say. We could make it harder for you to reinsure the car or to re-register the car, even in states that don't have emissions tests.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Ayers, who's a professor at Yale Law School and the Yale School of Management and editor of the Journal of Law, Economics and Organization. He has been a columnist for Forbes magazine, a commentator on public radio's Marketplace, and a contributor to the New York Times Freakonomics blog. His books include the New York Times bestseller Super Crunches and, most recently, Carrots and Sticks, Unlock the Power of Incentives to Get Things Done. He also has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Fix VW's Polluting Diesels and Fix the Recall System Too. So, given that you've made these suggestions, is there any, do you detect a national discussion going on here? The Congress is talking about shutting down the Congress over Planned Parenthood. So,
yeah,
what's your sense of who's paying attention here?
Well, I've gotten several supportive emails, but one would also have to have a healthy dose of cynicism that inertia, keeping things the way they are. I will say, too, that the other half of fixing the recall system is we have way too many low-stakes recalls that really are not about serious safety or emissions, public health issues. There are more recalls each year by a large margin than there are cars sold. And one of the things that could there's recall fatigue. One of the reasons that people don't respond to even serious recalls is that we are papered with so many non-serious recalls, and that if we could limit the recalls to those that were more serious, that is one of the ways that we could actually move toward a system with less hassle and safer cars on the road.
So is it possible that the automobile manufacturers have been, you know, issuing frivolous recalls to simply create the impression that this is not an important process, and by this blizzard of minor recalls, you call it recall fatigue, but it's also sort of almost a form of denial. There's
a
real problem.
Well, I don't think there is a process, but I don't think that there it's as insidious as trying to wear us down in this fashion. These recalls are expensive to the manufacturers. The majority of them are mandated or influenced by the NHTSA, that they occur after an investigation, and that the manufacturers, wanting to avoid the possibility of liability or sanction, are instead at a weak position. And I think that the NHTSA is mandating or twisting the arms for too many small potatoes recalls, and that partly, and it's analogous to hurricane fatigue. When if you ask the population to drop everything, if you cry wolf too many times on non-major weather issues, you could actually end up killing people when a major one comes along. And a similar kind of fatigue is, I think, the equilibrium where we are now. So I'd like to see fewer recalls, but at simultaneously more where we force owners to take them seriously.
Well, but shouldn't, if the National Highway and Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, can issue these mandates that you have to recall over whatever the issue is, it's odd that they don't have the enforcement mechanism to do the follow-up to make sure it happens. Is there any...
Very odd, but that's the... And one of the questions, sometimes the statutes haven't given them that. They don't want, they might be afraid, the Congress may be afraid of angering owners who don't want to have the hassle of taking their cars in. But it's the, at the federal level, we just have not required these things. And it's just, to my mind, mind-boggling that when it's a serious health hazard that these cars can stay on the road without sanction.
Well, it's also odd, isn't it, that you've got talk now that Volkswagen, I think they put aside $8 billion or something, but a lot of the coverage that's been out since this fraud was discovered, that the EPA can sue, because, and particularly the government itself, because the government's been defrauded. I think $55 million of taxpayer monies went as subsidies for these cars. Isn't it a bit odd that the EPA can collect money and that the relevant body, the NHTSA, doesn't have the ability to sanction?
I agree. And, I mean, this is such an unusual circumstance, though, where punitive damages are warranted for this serious bad action. Criminal liability may be in the offing. But I don't want to go too far to say that we have our patchwork of congressional acts and agency regulations that have been trying to move us toward increasingly safe highways. There's a lot of good intention, which has resulted in some loopholes and some areas for improvement. And I think this is a first order issue of trying to get some sanctioning ability to nationally coordinate taking some dangerous cars off the road once the unsafe aspect has been identified.
Well, I guess just in closing, do you think that this is going to hurt the movement away to alternative energy cars from gas guzzlers? Because my understanding is that, unfortunately, when the price of gas goes down, people buy less Priuses and Teslas and more big SUVs and trucks.
Well, that's my crystal ball is kind of cloudy on these issues. To see that, I can't really prognosticate well into the future on that that dimension. But I do look forward to the testing that's undoubtedly happening as we speak of the other manufacturers, just to so that we can regain confidence that or find out about the extent to which these defeat devices have been hurting us in other circumstances.
Well, Ian Ayres, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Ayres, who's a professor at Yale Law School and the Yale School of Management and editor of the Journal of Law, Economics and Organization. He has been a columnist for Forbes magazine and a commentator on public radio's Marketplace and a contributor to the New York Times' Freakonomics blog. His books include the New York Times bestseller Super Crunches and, most recently, Carrots and Sticks, Unlock the Power of Incentives to Get Things Done. He also has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Fix VW's Polluting Diesels and Fix the Recall System 2. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One time, one night.